On the agenda today, we're going to hear from a number of health-related boards, and then when Representative Kalin gets here with his bill, we'll be hearing that today, too. So let's start where we left off yesterday. I believe the first board to hear from is the Board of Social Work. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Zachertate, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. And unfortunately, I haven't had much of a voice this week, so I will do my best with this testimony. Thank you very much for the opportunity. You heard yesterday from a number of health licensing boards and from the board's administrative services unit. And what I would just like to highlight for you once again is that the HLBs, the health-related licensing boards, are not general fund supported. The boards are supported entirely by fees and are work out of the special revenue fund. All the boards voluntarily cooperate through the administrative services unit to provide our back-end business operations, for example, IT, purchasing, HR, contracts, payroll, and those sorts of back-end services. Getting more specific about the Board of Social Work. The Board of Social Work was established in 1987. We have a 15-person citizen board that serves to direct the board and operate with for policy. We have 10 individuals who are licensed as social workers that serve on the board and 5 public members. Our board meets 6 times per year, and our staff complement is 10.6 FTE. The board mission, like the other health-related licensing boards, is the mission of public protection. The Board of Social Work specifically licenses social workers, and we need to ensure that social workers meet minimum standards of competence. In addition, the board investigates and resolves complaints against social work practice. Some specific information about our licensee pool and the complaints that we receive. At this point in time, the Board of Social Work licenses 10,638 social workers in the state of Minnesota. We have licenses both at the bachelor's and graduate level. Our bachelor's practitioners comprise 49% of all of the licensed social workers in Minnesota, and the graduate level licensees then comprise 51%. Last year, the Board of Social Work issued 925 new licenses, and a trend in terms of social work licensing and social work regulation in this state is that we have had an increase of total number of licensed social workers, an increase of 9% in the last 10 years. So it does appear to be a growing profession. We also renew 4,525 licenses per year. In terms of our complaints, last year the board received 120 new complaints against social workers and their practice, and last year we resolved 112 complaints. Another trend in terms of complaints is that over the last biennium, we did see an increase of about 9.5% of new complaints that were coming to the board for resolution. I would also like to highlight our electronic government services. The Board of Social Work certainly offers online services. At this point in time, we are approaching 75% participation for our online renewal and online licensing services. We also offer address changes and services such as that. Another online service I would really like to highlight is that we provide online 24/7 license verification capabilities. And in less than the last 3 years, we have had 30,000 hits to our website from the general public, from the profession, to verify social work licenses, which is approximately 28 to 30 hits per day. An achievement that the board has completed this last fiscal year is that we produce a compliance video that is streaming live from our website, and that compliance video was produced to offer user information from both a public perspective and also from the perspective of a licensee in terms of how the board's compliance process works. A current project that the board has undertaken is to work towards electronic document managing, which means the ability to scan our documents to be more effective and efficient in terms of our record retention operations. Lastly, I will highlight our budget change item, which is one of the very important things that brings us to this committee. Essentially, the budget change item that the board submitted was approved by the governor and is included in the governor's budget. And this change item is essentially to maintain our current licensing fee rates and, in addition, allow for a 10% reduction in our fees. Piece of information that I need to bring to your attention. The change item that you have before you that was published in the governor's budget bill has had a slight change to it. When the board presented our budget change item to MM&B back in October, that change item was submitted with a four-year sunset date of 2013. And we were contacted, on January 15th by MM&B, and the board was directed to remove that sunset date and not have a sunset date in this temporary change item at all. The reason being is that MM&B informed the board that based on Minnesota Statute 16A, which requires all of the boards to essentially reassess fees every biennium, they did not think that the sunset date was necessary, that there was already a built-in process that would require the board to assess its fees. So I did just want to bring that to your attention. Thank you. The board's last fee increase, let me get a quick drink of water here. Sorry about that. Thank you for your patience. The board's last fee increase was in 2001. We were also granted by the legislature a temporary fee decrease in 2005, and that fee decrease sunsets this June 30th of 2009, which is really a good part for the impetus of this change item. And also, most importantly, even with the currently reduced fees that we are operating with, our revenues have still exceeded expenses. Two reasons are to bear for that. We have been over-collecting fees because, as I indicated previously, we have had a gradual increase over the years in terms of our number of licensees and applicants. In addition, the board has made a very serious commitment to streamline and reduce expenditures, which we have been able to do. The board and its finance committee gave very careful consideration to planning this biennial budget to be fiscally responsible and to comply with state regulations. The board solicited input from stakeholder groups, and as you might imagine, this fee decrease received no opposition and was quite frankly welcomed by stakeholder groups. Lastly, the board is appropriated $921,000 for fiscal year 10 and 11. If this change item were not to be approved and the fee decrease, the temporary fee decrease, were to sunset, our projected revenues would be $1,310,000, which is clearly more than our spending authority. And with this 10% reduction that the board is asking your support of, our projected revenues are to be $959,000, which is much more in line with the appropriations that we are granted. And that would allow us to better comply with Minnesota Statute 16A, which requires that the Health Licensing Board do their best to balance expenditures and revenues. In conclusion, even with the reduced revenues resulting from this fee reduction, this change item, which the board is hoping that you will support, the board will still have adequate funds to cover expenditures and to fulfill the board's duty to protect the public. Does the committee have any questions for me?
Any comments or questions? Representative Lane.
So you're asking us for to approve a fee reduction for people. Not a hard one. I have a question regarding the complaints. You said that the complaints had increased nearly 10%. Is that because the compliance video was online, or is that because you have more licensed social workers, or what do you attribute that to?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I expect that it could be any number of those things. The compliance video has been online only since this summer. But again, given the number of increases in our licensees, and I think the board is doing more initiatives in terms of public education to get the word out about the board's mission and our responsibility to take complaints, I think it could possibly be any one of those things, and I can't necessarily pinpoint for you what is the main reason, if there is one.
One more.
Representative.
Thank you. Another question is, you have 49% with a bachelor's degree. Are those grandfathered in today, or can you actually get a licensed social worker licensure with a bachelor's degree today?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, social work is one of the professions that does offer a bachelor's level license. These individuals are not grandparented. That occurred in the initial phases when licensing was passed. But in terms of social work education, there is a professional level degree offered at the bachelor's level, which is subject to national accreditation standards. And so that has been a license that the board has been offering and required to offer since the inception of licensing.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much for your testimony today.
You're very welcome. Thank you, members of the committee.
So next, we're going to hear from the Board of Pharmacy. Oh, and I might announce that we have 9th to 12th grade students here from Humboldt Senior High School, and they are participating in the Minnesota Historical Society's Capital Historic Site Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Educational Program. Why don't you stand up so we can welcome you. Thank you for coming. The one thing I'd ask you to think about is that someday you might want to be sitting at this table making some of these decisions, okay? Think about that. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Wybert. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. I might just take a second to say that when I was a high school student, I actually did an internship at the Capitol. I'm not sitting where you are, but I'm testifying before you.
Very good.
The Minnesota Board of Pharmacy was founded in 1885, so we celebrate our 125th anniversary next year. It consists of 7 members, 5 of whom are pharmacists and 2 of whom are public members, all appointed by the governor. We license or register approximately 20,000 individuals and businesses. In that regard, we're a little bit different than most of the other health licensing boards in that we do license businesses. We license pharmacies, drug wholesalers, drug manufacturers, and the facilities of controlled substance researchers. That also means that we do inspections of facilities, which is a little bit different than some of the other health licensing boards. Other than that, we operate very much the same way that my colleagues have described to you. We are fee-based. We get no money from the general fund. Our fees have not increased since 2000. Last fiscal year, we received 94 complaints. We resolved 76 of those before the end of the fiscal year, and we issued about a dozen disciplinary orders. Some members have asked about increases in complaints. Ours actually peaked several years ago at about 110, and they've actually gone down a little bit. The board's mission, as is the mission of the other health licensing boards, is to protect the public through examination and licensure of pharmacists in the businesses that I mentioned. Our core functions include setting the standards for initial and continuing licensure and actually issuing the licenses and registrations. Like the other health licensing boards, we offer online renewal, license renewals. Currently, over 90% of pharmacists and over 80% of pharmacy technicians renew online. As I mentioned, we also conduct unannounced inspections of all pharmacies and drug wholesalers, drug manufacturers, and medical gas distributors and controlled substance researchers. We respond to the complaints that I mentioned. We take disciplinary action when it's appropriate after investigating the complaints. If you turn your attention to what I hope is page 5, that talks about the change summary that was part of the governor's budget. Excuse me. There are just a couple of things that are listed on there. A couple of reductions. The one-time appropriation of $29,000 reflects some money set aside for retirement of one of the inspectors that I anticipate will happen. That money is actually, as was meant to be yesterday, going to be flowing through our administrative services unit rather than directly to the board. There's a little bit of an error here. I didn't get a chance to review this in its entirety before it was published by management budget, but it talks about a program agency sunset of $25,000. Then it actually adds that money down a few lines further for open spending. That's actually referring to something the legislature established a couple years ago called the Cancer Drug Repository Program. That is not sunsetting per se. There's still a chance for pharmacies and health-related facilities to set up a cancer drug repository if they want to. But what we've realized is we don't need to spend $25,000 of the fees we collect to actually have staff work on that. After the initial work that was done the first year, there's very, very little work that goes into that. So that's what that's about. Then I'd like to turn your attention to page 6 and just highlight something that our board has really directed me to let the legislature know we're going to need some guidance on. And I'll have to be talking to the chief authors of the bill that the legislature passed in 2007, which would be Senator Berglund and Representative Abler. In 2007, our board was directed to establish by January of 2010 a controlled substance prescription electronic reporting system. And in essence, controlled substances, for those of you who may not know this, are drugs that have legitimate medical purposes, but they also can be abused. And so they're placed in what are called controlled substance schedules by both the federal and state government. These are drugs like OxyContin and Valium and Vicodin, drugs you may have heard of. The intent of this program is to reduce the amount of controlled substances that are diverted for abuse, ultimately. Drugs are diverted for abuse in a variety of different ways. One of the ways in which they're diverted is through what's known as doctor shopping, which is essentially an individual going from doctor to doctor, emergency room to emergency room, getting multiple prescriptions for a drug, and then going to multiple pharmacies to have those prescriptions filled. Sometimes it's entirely for their own use. Sometimes they actually sell it on the street to generate revenues to purchase more drugs in this manner. So about 3/4 of the states have prescription drug monitoring programs, and the federal government is encouraging this through the grant program. The board was directed to apply for a federal grant to implement such a program, if the program is implemented, what we'll be doing is every controlled substance prescription that's dispensed in the state will be electronically reported to the board, stored in a database, and then physicians and other prescribers and pharmacies will be able to access that database securely to look at profiles of patients to see if someone they're treating might be of concern in terms of getting these substances from multiple other prescribers. The problem that the board faces is we did apply for and get the federal grant. It's just under $400,000. But as you'll note on page 6, as part of the governor's recommendation, some of that money would be spent this fiscal year to start the implementation. Some would be spent next fiscal year, but there's no federal funding in the last fiscal year of the biennium. When the legislature passed the law, they didn't include any permanent state funding. So our problem is, how do we fund the program when the federal money runs out? And I have several different options, and I don't want to take the committee's time up today with that. And I'll be talking to, again, Representative Abler and Senator Berglund about some of those options. And with that, I would be glad to take any questions the committee might have.
Any questions for Mr. Weiberg? Representative Lane.
Thank you. I would assume that this database then would be accessible across state lines, so that if somebody was getting prescriptions in one state and coming to another, that would be seen on the database?
Madam Chair, Representative, the initial phase, no. However, after the initial grant that we get from the federal government, we can apply for what's called a enhancement grant. The enhancement grant cannot be used to operate the program, but it can be used to make enhancements to the program, as the name implies. I've already had discussions with my counterparts in North Dakota, which is the one state in the surrounding area that has a functional program, about making the databases interoperable. And the federal agency that sponsors these grants does want to see that. And so we are planning in the second phase, if you will, of the program to expand it across state lines, at least to the bordering states that have operating programs. But this first phase, we would not be doing that.
Further discussion? Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Weiberg, is the board familiar with the problem that's developing with allowing pharmacists to give immunizations to kids that are 10 years or older?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, we are aware that there is an issue with that. The board has worked with the Pharmacists Association actually to amend the Practice Act to clarify that the intent of the legislature was to allow pharmacists to give influenza vaccines to persons 10 and older, and also the change would allow pharmacists to sign legally valid prescriptions when they're working under protocol. We were working with MPHA on that. We thought that first part was a technical change. We thought the second part might be the controversial part, and I am aware that the first part has become controversial. My understanding is that the Department of Human Services, which I used to work for as the Medicaid Pharmacy Program Manager, and the Department of Health have some concerns about this law in terms of a federal free vaccine program, which I have to admit I'm not entirely familiar with, because of all the drug-related issues, the two areas that I did not have responsibility for when I was at DHS were vaccines and a program that provided certain people with AIDS-related drugs. But my understanding is that there are some DHS and Department of Health believe that there are some issues with allowing pharmacists to do that in terms of this federally funded free vaccine program for children.
Other questions? I have just one. When you talk about the fact that the governor didn't make this a permanent funding, were you thinking of increasing your fees to add it into the year 2011? Is that one of your options?
Madam Chair, that was one of the options. One of the options was to increase our fees, not entirely to fund this program. As I mentioned, we have not increased our fees since 2001. And we have had an increase in the number of pharmacies licensed, the number of controlled substance researchers licensed. The legislature actually approved in the last budget session authority to spend additional money to hire an additional inspector. And so part of it was to keep that additional inspector, but that was part of the reason for increasing the fee adjustment.
Okay, thank you. If there's no further questions, appreciate your coming. And we'll be hearing next from the Board of Nursing. We are waiting for Representative Taylor, and then when he comes, we'll interrupt our hearing. But for now, we're going to hear from the Board of Nursing. Welcome to the committee, Inspector.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Shirley Brecken, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you some things about the work of the board. The board was established in 1907 and is comprised of 16 members, 8 registered nurses, 4 licensed practical nurses, and 4 public members. Their role and the purpose of the agency is to provide the public with reasonable assurance that the individuals who practice nursing do so competently, ethically, and safely. And so all of the agency's functions are directed toward that end. As you know, the board regulates the practice of nearly 104,000 registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and advanced practice registered nurses. We are the largest of the health-related licensing boards. This number is an increase of approximately 20% of licensees in the last 2 biennia, and this is really largely due to the increase in the number of graduates from Minnesota programs. In addition to licensing, the board also maintains a registry of advanced practice nurses and public health nurses, and a rather unique law that allows individuals who are licensed in the border states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, and North Dakota, to practice nursing in Minnesota based on that state's license. The uniqueness of it is that Minnesota nurses do not have the same privilege. They may not go to those other states to practice based on their Minnesota license, so it is not reciprocal. I'd like to share with you that even though we've had this significant increase in the number of licensees, we do anticipate a shortage of nurses due to the aging, of course, of the general population as well as the aging of the nursing workforce. Of the currently licensed nurses in Minnesota, we have nearly 55% of them will be over the age of 55 by the year 2015. And I think all of us realize that 6 years, 6, 7 years can go very quickly. In addition to licensure, the board approves nursing education programs. The board has approved 11 new nursing education programs within the last 2 biennia. This is an increase of 21% in the number of nursing education programs in Minnesota. And this is very significant in comparison to the previous 10 years when the board did not approve any new nursing education programs. There are currently 65 nursing education programs in Minnesota for practical nursing, associate degree nursing, and baccalaureate degree nursing. There's also 1 master's entry preparing program. The board processes over 1,200 complaints per year. With the increase in the number of nurses, the number of complaints regarding unsafe practice has increased by approximately 28% in the last biennium, last 2 biennium. Like the other health-related licensing boards, the Board of Nursing is a fee-based agency, and we have not raised fees since the last fee increase was in 1999. The board is committed to operating as efficiently as possible. In fact, a recent comparison with other boards of nursing across the country shows that the Minnesota Board of Nursing is actually operating at $13 per licensee less than all of the average of the other licensing nursing boards in the country. One of the ways that we have accomplished this is, like the other health-related licensing boards, through electronic services. In fact, over 90% of all licensure activities are transacted online today. And we're especially proud of our license application process for new graduates. New graduates of Minnesota Nursing Education programs are able to apply for a license, check the status of their license, apply to take the licensure exam, take the licensure exam, and get the results of that exam and their license all electronically. It is virtually a paperless system. Finally, I would like to address the change item which the governor has put forward. The board is requesting funding in the biennium to add a legal analyst position to the board staff for the purpose of drafting documents necessary to resolve open cases. As I said earlier, complaints to the Board of Nursing have increased by approximately 28% since 2002. As you know, the board gets its legal services from the Attorney General's office. However, the Attorney General's office has decreased the number of support staff it has to draft legal documents. At this time, we have over 600 open discipline cases, with over 100 cases awaiting documents to be drafted. Adding this position will decrease the amount of time to resolve discipline cases and increase public safety. And since the board has historically paid the Attorney General's office for the drafting of documents, it's actually a shift of moving that function to the board. The question that's been asked, will that reduce your budget or your spending to the Attorney General's office? And the answer is unfortunately no. And the reason for that is because of the increased number of complaints and the increase in fees that the Attorney General's office charges for other services. That concludes my comments, and I would be happy to answer any questions of the committee members.
Representative Saylor. Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I would like to know is there any trend in the nature of the complaints that come into your office, any particular topic that you hear more or less about?
Second. Madam Chair, Representative Saylor. We've actually looked at that, at the types of complaints and do categorize them. Approximately 50% of the complaints deal with either chemical dependency or other illnesses related that would impair an individual's ability to practice nursing safely. And that stays fairly constant through the years. The only thing is that the numbers have increased, but the percentage is approximately the same. We have seen a definite increase in the number of cases that involve convicted felons or individuals who have been convicted of gross misdemeanors. And for that reason, the board is currently in the process of evaluating the feasibility to do criminal background checks through fingerprinting and FBI studies. In addition to that, the other area that we are most likely to get complaints related to are the failure to practice nursing safely, and that's generally for a variety of reasons. It might be medication errors or failure to document and communicate effectively, or failure to supervise other nursing personnel effectively. Those would be the three major areas that we see.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Brecky. Sorry, it's the same sort of problem everyone else apparently has. I guess I'm just wondering, have you seen any changes in any complaints about number of staffing? Has that been something that has come in where people are complaining about staffing needs?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, the board only occasionally, I would say it's very infrequent that we get complaints about staffing patterns or a number of staff, or that staffing has been cited as a reason for or a cause for an unsafe nursing practice situation.
Thank you. With budget reductions and hospitals' budgets being reduced and clinics, I hear there's laying off of nurses. So how is that impacting your group? You talk about there being a shortage of nurses coming up, but the reality might be, at least in the short term, that there would be nurses without jobs.
Madam Chair, Representative Blaine. I think that that's probably something that might lull us into a little bit of a phase, you know, a situation that's probably rather unsafe, and that is the idea that because hospitals are laying off nurses, that there indeed is not a shortage, nor could we predict that there will be a shortage. First of all, there's no question this population of nurses is aging. As I said, over 55% of nurses will be over the age of 55, you know, in just a very short time by 2015. Secondly, hospitals have, well, they've been as a major employer of nurses, nurses are employed in many other settings, and those employment situations keep increasing. Assisted living, home care, other kinds of care models other than hospital or long-term care. Additionally, I think that we will expect, and quite frankly, it just is not possible for the schools, even with the aging population and the kind of what you're seeing right now, that the short-term layoffs, that we'll be able to produce enough nurses to meet that shortage when it occurs. Minnesota is somewhat fortunate in that things move from the coast to the Midwest in terms of trends. Workforce trends. Many other states have very high shortages right now. We've been very fortunate in Minnesota because traditionally we've been an exporter of nurses. We've had nursing education programs that have been able to graduate sufficient numbers and then export them to other states.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? Okay, if not, thank you very much.
Thank you, members of the committee.
And I see that Representative Kalin has arrived, so if you're ready, Representative Kalin, do you need a moment? Okay. So, committee, we're going to suspend the hearing from the health-related board for the moment and take Representative Kalin still. And that is in your packet, and there is a delete everything amendment as well. This is the first bill for the committee as well, Representative Kalin, for this year, as well as, I believe, the first stop for your bill.
Yes.
And so we'll need to have... we'll need to, in order to bring the bill before, we need someone to move the bill.
So moved.
Okay, Representative Lane moves that the House File 680 be passed, and it would be forwarded to the Senate Finance, where it would then be on its way to. How many other committees?
Madam Chair, a recommendation to full finance to re-refer to the committee, the Division on Energy Finance.
Okay, and it might be helpful for this committee to know that, as you said to me yesterday, how many different stops this bill is going to make.
Madam Chair and members, I can... Before jumping into a big description of the bill, currently the bill is scheduled to be heard in energies in the following divisions of finance. Easier to describe it that way: the Energy Finance Division, State Government Finance, Workforce Development Division, and then being heard in the full Higher Education and Workforce Finance Committee. We're still working out the dates on that piece. And we are in negotiations with the local government committee to see whether they need to, I think an informational hearing will probably suffice there, and then we still have to work out details on with the Department of Education and the implications on the K-12 division, and then we'll have full finance ways and means, and hopefully get Minnesotans to work as soon as we possibly can.
Okay, so I count six committees. Representative Stevenson, you had a...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to get to see this bill again after it's gone through those, or is this our only shot at it?
This committee will not be seeing this bill again, unless we don't get our work done today. But this bill today will go from here back to finance, then to one of the next six committees that's going to... If you happen to be on any of those other committees, you know, you'd have a chance to talk about it. But this committee today will be our opportunity to...
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Unless there was some major change, I guess, that would bring it back here. But at this point, I don't foresee that.
And I think, you know, obviously we're seeing a DE1 amendment before us here, and one of the first things we did when we put the committee together, Madam Chair, you put the rules out and basically said there was a 24-hour rule on amendments. I understand that there's a fast-track intent on this particular bill, and it goes to a lot of different committees, but I also think that we started this this year in terms of talking about a transparent system, one that has a full vetting of the policies that we're getting ready to implement. And this has huge implications in terms of housing and what this committee addresses. Whether or not we're actually able to address these issues today will be interesting to see. And as we go, I mean, our staff just got this bill half hour ago, literally an hour ago. So our ability to really take a look and see what the implications are long term, read into the statutes, what is trying to be done here, kind of puts us at a disadvantage. And our hopes are, Madam Chair, that if we're going to do the 24-hour, we're going to waive this, that, you know, the same advantages will be given to the minority as we bring forth amendments and those type of things, because this makes it extremely difficult for us to read through and then try and put any corrections that we deem would be appropriate, bring those forth in the committee, and hopefully there'll be some leniency, Madam Chair, in terms of oral amendments.
Sure. Representative Peterson, we talked about this before the committee began, and as I mentioned to you earlier, we do have a 24-hour rule with the opportunity for the chair to waive this, and the author of the bill did come to me 2 days ahead of time to talk about waiving that rule, so, and to look at some amendments. And I believe, according to my staff, your staff should have had this at 9, but it's still a very short period of time, and so we'll have as much conversation as we need to have in this committee, absolutely. I do think that the jurisdiction of the committee is limited, and we can go through the whole bill and look at the whole bill, but I think as you can tell from the different committees that this is going to go through, there's going to be a lot of work on this bill. This is just the first shot of it, and so I'm hoping that we can kind of stick with pretty much with what's at hand in terms of what this committee's jurisdiction is. Representative Morgan?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the concerns expressed by Representative Severson. Over the last year and a half, the Government Operations Committee took a great deal of time and energy to look at the process and the committee process and the floor process, and one of the things in a bipartisan way we discussed was trying to provide more information, particularly to the minority, in a timely fashion so that they can contribute to the debate in a way that is very important to the nature of the debate. And I hope that that in the little bit of time that you've had, you're able to feel comfortable making the arguments you need to make and getting the amendments drafted. I've seen our able House research analyst here, Ms. Cleveland, run out to do some amendments earlier, and I'm glad she was able to get back so quickly. I hope that's helpful. I also want to emphasize another one of the conclusions that the Government Operations Committee reached, and that was in a bill like this, and Representative Kalin, kudos to you to try to break Representative Hortman's record for most committees reached by a bill, that we focus the work of the committees in the areas of the scope of the committees. And I discussed this with you earlier on in a bit of a sidebar. I hope that the Workforce Development Committee, the State Government Finance Committee, would not be making any changes to the housing areas of the bill that we address today and perhaps even amend today. Just as I would think that they would hope, we would not be messing around with the portions of the bill that they are going to have responsibility for. Of course, we'll all have a chance to see this again on the House floor. So I appreciate your interest, Madam Chair, in focusing the bill on the areas this committee is responsible for. Let other committees do their work, and we'll all have a chance to see it again on the floor. So thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. And, you know, the way we'll deal with that, of course, is voting to determine any of the amendments that are offered. So, Representative Lane, do you want to offer the delete everything amendment to House File 680 so that we can put the bill in the order that the author prefers?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will do that.
Okay. Representative Lane moves that House File 680 be amended with the delete everything amendment, that is the DE1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. And the amendment is before us as your bill, Representative Kalin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. The bill we have before us now, House File 680, is bill to put Minnesotans back to work as soon as we can, and focus on the energy efficiency investments that are coming to Minnesota. Hopefully within the next week or two, we will have a presidential signature on the H.R. 1, the Federal Recovery Act, that some of us call stimulus, some of us call recovery. I think those pieces are interchangeable. The advantage to the approach taken in House File 680 is several fold. First, the energy efficiency jobs that we need to be generating and creating serve many purposes. They're win-win-wins. They not only replace unemployment checks with paychecks for dozens of Minnesotans within 30 days, hundreds of Minnesotans within 60 days, and potentially thousands of Minnesotans within 90 days of the governor's signature on this bill. It also saves us tax dollars on the public building renovation side. It saves us tax dollars on the low-income heating assistance households that rely on that public assistance because of their very low income status. By tightening up those homes and weatherizing those homes, we'll move down a road where hopefully within our lifetimes, and hopefully even within a decade, we might be able to wean Minnesota off of the need for LIHEAP dollars for low income heating assistance. As an overview, some of you might be asking why a need to move an energy efficiency bill sooner than House File 1 and create this framework. And the reality is that this is the fastest way that we can put people to work. We've heard the term shovel ready. Shovels aren't needed on energy efficiency projects. Wrenches, testing meters, a hard hat and a tool belt and gloves, packing insulation. This is the work that we can do within 30 and 45 days, and the channels exist today to put people to work. What we want to make sure is that we are stretching and maximizing that investment and the job opportunities in Minnesota and making wise moves along the way. I believe that within this committee's jurisdiction, the sections that are most applicable are sections 1, 2, 6, and 7. But I will walk through the whole bill. And as Madam Chair, you characterized the bill, I think, quite accurately in that the hope is to start with a framework and then allow members and stakeholders through the process to both educate us and also improve the bill along the way. Section 1 establishes both the general framework and the principles for the energy efficiency programs. In Minnesota, those funds will come to the Office of Energy Security. We want to maximize job creation and energy conservation and efficiency gains, with still a focus on that on cost effectiveness and cost effective projects, as you see in item 2 in subdivision 2 on page 1. We want to have distribution across the state to make sure that all Minnesotans have an opportunity for these jobs, that we're making smart energy investments along the way. Working with Madam Chair, with you, Madam Chair, we added an important indications about wanting to make sure that these are sustainable jobs, that we're not providing $7 or $8 an hour jobs where we then force folks to apply for MinnesotaCare at the same time as applying for a job application. And also want to make sure we protect health and safety of workers. I want to commend the staff of the Office of Energy Security generally and specifically on the recovery endeavor. I've worked closely with them for 3 years as an active member of the Energy Committee. I know Representatives Bly and Saylor are also on that committee, and I think that the partnership that we have with the Office of Energy Security is phenomenal, and I think there's great opportunity here to put people to work doing the right thing. Section 2 is the residential weatherization section. It's a minimal section currently because for two reasons. One is we are waiting to see whether any last moves will be made at the federal level about restricting funds. But also I think that reflects the fact that the guidelines are very strong at the federal level. And the community action partnership, the community action agencies implement these weatherization programs currently. We need to make sure that they have the capacity to continue to deliver a large increase of the homes we're going to weatherize, and I'll talk about that in a second. But we also want to make sure that we're reaching out into new markets that haven't been touched as much, and that's the low-income rental units, where I think we're seeing as much need for energy assistance as in single-family residents that are owned by the homeowner, or owned by the family staying in those homes. Currently, just a little bit of background on weatherization. 400,000 households in Minnesota are eligible, income eligible, for low-income heating assistance. 400,000 are eligible. We serve 165,000 of those 400,000 with energy assistance, with federal dollars and an augmentation of state funds. Of those 400,000 eligible households and 165,000 that we serve, fewer than 3,800 of those homes are weatherized currently, every year. It'll take us over a century, assuming the rest of the field is static, over a century to really do the work that we need to do to reduce Minnesotans' reliance on federal help. If we are successful in lobbying the conference committee, and they report a bill out and pass it, and the president signs it, Minnesota may have the funds to weatherize as much as 35,000 homes a year. That's an 8- or 9-fold increase. So we have to be looking at the capacity. We will need 500, upwards of 500 with that 35,000 number, 500 new home energy auditors. Currently a training that's provided by Dunwoody and others. We are looking at partnering with them to expand that to a 2-week training so that there's some more robustness. But you can imagine the challenges and the opportunities that come from scaling up at that level, from contractors, insulators, carpenters, HVAC contractors, as well as even folks that have some energy background, like architects and engineers, that have a 30% unemployment rate in those fields. Talk to some who are interested in becoming project managers or even home energy auditors. Sections 3, 4, and 5 relate to using the state energy program dollars, which is a separate fund from the weatherization funds coming in under the recovery bill. Currently, the Office of Energy Security is implementing a public building energy efficiency enhancement program. You see it referred to on lines 2.21 and twice. It's a tax-exempt lease purchase mechanism. We can use the federal funds to stretch those dollars much further. Those three sections are really the purview of the Energy, Education, State Government Finance Committees, and I'm working with the chair and anyone else who's interested in making sure that public housing is considered a local government building and eligible for that program. But the framework exists today. It doesn't exist in most other states, so I think it puts us an advantage. Section 6 is unique to Minnesota, I think, and the opportunity. We cannot use weatherization dollars, federal dollars, to do window replacement absent lead abatement partnerships. Provided we get a robust amount of state energy program dollars from the recovery bill, we can use those dollars to become efficient in our delivery and repair of the homes we're going to weatherize by replacing windows. As we know, we are the Silicon Valley of windows, with Marvin and Anderson Windows and 3M making every film you could possibly imagine for a window, Cardinal Glass in Eden Prairie, and we have other nascent companies that are growing up and building off that leadership position. Anderson Windows has announced, I think, something like, and Representative McNamara might be able to correct my numbers, but I remember from talking to Mr. Humphrey and reading in the paper, the CEO of Anderson, they've laid off, I think, 800 employees in 2 rounds of layoffs, as well as terminated probably about 100 positions, if I remember right. Early indications are, if we get that robust funding for the state energy program that we can use to purchase windows, Anderson might be able to call back a vast majority, if not even all of them. This ripples through our economy in a very positive way. The multiplier there is great. And so we want to develop that window replacement augmentation program. Section 7 is the training and workforce development. I mentioned the home energy auditors. On the public building side, Johnson Controls, an energy service company, left 111 vacant positions that were unfilled last construction season because they couldn't find enough system technicians to fill those positions. The two-year training program. They're working to help fill those, but I think we can be more aggressive in that public-private partnership to meet that need to do the building assessment on the institutional level. Energy managers and building operator certification is are elements that we need to continue that ongoing work on the institutional level. And subdivision 3 on the last page, Madam Chair, is a guide to the funds, the program director within the Office of Energy Security to make sure that we're reaching out to those communities that have disproportionately high rates of unemployment. And you can see them listed on lines 4-7 and 4-8. But then we also, in addition to the outreach, we also are directing them to utilize existing capacity. We don't want to reinvent the wheel here. We want to deliver programs and get people to work as soon as possible. And so that capacity includes our skilled trades, labor unions, our community action partnerships, tribal colleges, and as well as nonprofit organizations that have deep experience and expertise in energy efficiency. I believe we have the capacity to handle the thousands of job opportunities and the millions and hundreds of millions of dollars that will come to Minnesota if we get action in Congress. I want to make sure we make that investment as wise and as deep as we can, and that it's ongoing and building capacity to do what we know is right in terms of the budget, right in terms of paychecks rather than unemployment checks, and right in terms of air quality, environmental protection, healthy housing. I know that these are things that you consider in this committee. Lastly, Madam Chair and members, what's not in the bill? There's no state dollars other than the ongoing capacity within the Office of Energy Security and the other support funding. Our two mechanisms ultimately in this bill for putting folks to work are going to be the federal recovery dollars and then the private investments from folks like Johnson Controls and Honeywell to the utilities that have a conservation improvement mandate to save energy and to show those kilowatt hour savings, to other partnerships that I think we don't know yet might emerge over the next few weeks. Some of those folks are in the room today and will help us as the bill proceeds through the committee process. But I urge you to help us put Minnesotans to work, to increase the stability and health of our housing stock in Minnesota, and maximize the economic recovery as soon as we can.
Thank you. Did you have some witnesses you wanted to have to testify today?
There are a few folks who I think will speak very briefly.
Okay.
Someone from Higher Minnesota is here. I know. I don't know if Mr. King wants to come up and speak. If you'd like to join us, I know that there are a couple of others who the staff has heard from, and I know the Office of Energy Security is here to answer questions as well.
Okay.
So, one up.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lewis King, President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC. I'm also the co-chair, along with Mr. Will Seeger, of Higher Minnesota. Higher is an acronym for Healthcare, Infrastructure, and Renewable Energy. We are a cross-section of members of this community who come together to form a broad-based coalition to assist in influencing the development of policy for this new green economy that is upon us. In addition, we are very much concerned with infrastructure issues, especially as we see the work being done in NDOT and in phase two of our operation. We will focus on healthcare jobs once that industry begins to rebound. Thank you for the opportunity to appear today. And I first want to thank Representative Kalin and yourself, Madam Chair, for your leadership around this issue and the members of the Green Jobs Task Force. We our purpose is to assist in the development of this bill. We understand that it is a first step and that it is even changing from yesterday to today. This morning, though, we would like to highlight a few matters that we view as crucial in the development of this legislation so that it has maximum impact as designed for all Minnesotans. First,
We view the effort to provide work opportunities for all Minnesotans across the state as crucial. Equally important is to recognize the importance of strategic targeting in the urban core, where in certain communities there are disproportionate utilization of services in the absence of employment, and this provides us with a very good opportunity to address those issues. The coalition would like to see specific benchmarks for enrollment and training and the actual hiring of women, low-income people in communities of color, and the same for utilizing contractors from these populations. And we recognize that this is an opportunity to actually put measures in place and then quantify our results at the end of the day so that we move beyond good intentions. Line 4.4 draws attention to the federal intent to stem the tide of unemployment afflicting our country and our community. In the spirit of fulfilling this intent, it's crucial that the law specify a requirement to recruit rather than an attempt. This is all about unemployed people, and I remind you of a scene that was on television a couple of weeks ago as we saw 1,200 people in Miami compete for 35 firefighting jobs. And there are people out there who are looking forward to these opportunities, and there should be vigorous recruitment across all communities to ensure that they have an opportunity. Further, in these communities, poverty has ranged from 25% to 45%, and unemployment as high as 14% when the metro average was 4%. So again, I cannot stress the importance of making sure that we get this right across the board, because as we face the budget realities that force us to cut social programs, we should not shy away from setting employment goals for these communities so that we can provide these folks with the opportunity to pursue the best social service program in the world, a job. Finally, throughout the bill, sole sourcing is mentioned as a way of getting things done. And I understand the need for speed. In my former line of business as an Army officer, once you made a decision to go, you tried to get there as quickly as possible. However, we should also be very careful not to pursue speed at the expense of competition, innovation, cost, and equitable access to economic opportunities. This cannot be business as usual. And at the end of the day, when all is said and done, by 2010, the score will be out there, and we'll know whether or not this actually happened. So it is our intent to assist Representative Kalin, Senator Ellen Anderson in the Senate to get this legislation through. We ask for your support, and we look forward to working with you to ensure that the outcome is best for all Minnesotans. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. King, any questions or comments? All right, thank you very much. And I want to just say I really appreciate all the work you've been doing on this, too. Any other witnesses? You want another person from?
Thank you. Ms. Pam Marshall from Energy Sense. No, I don't think so. I don't know if anyone from Community Action Partnership. Mr. Anderson wants to testify.
Madam Chair and members, last summer when oil was at $145 per barrel, Minnesota Community Action Partnership. We were already in conversations anticipating the housing disaster that would be before this committee this session. We're absolutely thrilled to be having this conversation instead, and we very much look forward to working with all the partners to make the best possible use of these once-in-a-generation funds to try to improve the situation of low-income Minnesotans throughout the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Any questions for Ms. Anderson? Comments? Thank you very much. I think I saw Mr. Mean's hand. Did you? Yeah. Well, the testify, and then I think if that's it in terms of witnesses, then we'll get to the questions from committee members. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Bill Means, the Executive Director of Minnesota OIC State Council. As most of you know, OIC has been here a long time, delivering training, job placement. We have five programs in the state, and that's why I wanted to kind of justify why you see our name in the bill itself. We can very much help you in the statewide delivery. And as well, I'm glad to see community action here because we're working to establish another OIC in Wilmer and working with the Wilmer Community Action Program. So I want to say that we place around 700 people a year into jobs, and these are the people that are most in need. A lot of the people that apply for WIA, Workforce Investment Act funds, are not eligible. Those that apply that are not eligible many times are referred to OIC. So we're serving the most in need. And we have a return on investment this past year, this past fiscal year, that every dollar the state invested in OIC, we returned $21 in services. Well documented. We have five programs, three in the urban area, one on Mille Lacs Reservation and one in Bemidji. We have a partnership with Dunwoody and we have a partnership with the Minsky Institution where we have OIC. So I just want to make you feel confident, let you know that we're prepared to help deliver these jobs and training in and around this stimulus package as well. Most of our institutions, three out of the five, are accredited. So we have you know, we can transfer credits back and forth with Minsky. We have a long-term working relationship, and I thank you all for trying to implement this bill in a speedy manner. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments to the witness? Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mees, you said that you were referenced in this bill. Can you point out to what section of the bill you referenced?
We're on subsection 3. Training Activity Guidelines, Opportunities, Industrialization Center.
4.9.
We were a little miffed that we weren't capitalized, but other than that.
Madam Chair, yeah, to that point. Yeah, I when I saw that, I thought, I've never heard of that before. Mm. And so I didn't understand that that was a set-apart designated organization. Which, Madam Chair, I think goes to the previous testifier, Mr. King, was talking about not getting into the trap of single sourcing here. So we will have some discussion on that, Madam Chair. Yep. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I might...
Representative Seaman.
Representative Severson, about 3 months ago, maybe even 2 months ago, I was in the same position you were in. It's been a learning curve for me in terms of learning a lot of the resources that are out there that I think are below the radar to some of us. And been really encouraging learning more about OICs and working with these guys, but learning that, you know, they're I think part of the state capacity that we haven't tapped into enough, and so I'll leave it at that for now.
One comment to the question: we do have a performance-based contract with D that we've had in place since 1984. So we are a very well-known organization in implementing state policy and dollars.
Thank you very much. Okay, unless there's any further questions, we'll turn to the committee members. And I think I had Representative McFarland and Representative Peterson so far. And Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kalin. I'm going to put these in the form of questions, and you don't necessarily need to answer them, but they're points that I would like to have clarified in the future committees, most likely. On page 1, let's see, section... Subdivision 2, number 3, line 120 and 121. It talks to about the projects geographically distributed across the state. Who's going to determine that, and how will they determine the geographic balance?
Representative Taylor.
He doesn't necessarily need to answer each one, unless he'd like to.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland might be able to list them, and if there are some that I think, you know, warrant specific comments, I'll make them. Otherwise, I'll continue to keep working on these issues and these issues of benchmarking and the other. And
I'll list the three concerns, right, and maybe you might have an answer for me.
Right, Ellen, go ahead.
The second one would be on second page, line one. It talks about achieving high indoor quality. Would that be national standards or state standards? Who's going to determine what that would be? And then on page three, section six, it talks about existing housing occupied by low and moderate income households. What's the criteria for those areas? Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might I'll click off them quickly. I think we have some more work to do on the benchmarking on your first question of geographic distribution. And we will have benchmarks. I wanted to develop them with the Office of Energy Security more thoroughly so that we have consensus on not having over-reporting and slowing down the process of doing the work we need to do. Indoor air quality, I think, is actually something we need to speak more directly with the program implementers and look at the federal rules, but be very careful about not restricting and creating maximum flexibility program while getting the job done that we want. And I'll follow up with you on what we hear. On the lower moderate income households, on the weatherization, I can only comment. I think on the windows component, we'll have some more work to do. The requirement for weatherization on income is households who are at or below 50% of the state median income. And so there are, the shot, I think that's where the 400,000 household number comes from. It's from that figure. So that's kind of, I don't know what that dollar figure is today, but it's very, very low, and it should be a concern to all of us, I think.
Okay. Next, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to just, number one, say I think it's a great proposal that winterization, you know, in terms of weatherization of our housing stock, particularly for low income, for 400,000 is an effective way of going forward in this process. And I think, I know you're Representative Caitlin, and you're a guy that likes to have all the I's dotted and T's crossed. So going through this process, my hopes are that, you know, and I think you're a fair individual that wants to produce the best product we can here. So I applaud you on that criteria. There's some areas of this bill that are immediately causing me some concern. And obviously, our housing sector has taken a tremendous hit in this last year. And there are many people who are out of work, both union and non-union. And a lot of our builders are operating in the teens in terms of what they, or percentages of what they had the capacity 2 or 3 years ago. So they are hurting. So I think in terms of putting a stimulus package forward, there needs to be an open resource for those people to be able to tie into these dollars as well. And in line with that, I had a couple of questions, but I'd like to test the waters here first. And page 1, line 26 and 27, Madam Chair, I would move to delete line 26 and 27, saying, preference shall be given to projects with jobs paying a living wage and protect occupational health and safety of the workers. And Madam Chair and members, the reason I bring that forward is because I think what we're doing here is we're beginning to paint a picture that we are going to steer these jobs in a particular area. And I think if this is truly an economic stimulus package, then it needs to go out and be competitively bid for all those who are willing to step up to the plate and put their services forth in a manner that would be a benefit not just to community, but to the state in creating jobs.
If that's a formal motion, let's get it on the table. Is that your motion?
That is my motion.
Okay, Representative Stevenson moves deletion of line 1.26 and 1.27 on page 1. Give it a second. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just want to make sure we had a motion that you...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I believe this opens it up a little bit larger availability and doesn't put the constraints on it, but I think could prohibit that.
Representative McNamara?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And one of my questions for the author, and again, like Representative Severson, Representative Kalin, you and I did get to talk about this bill. When you were nodding your head, if it was meant to, would I have been willing to move the bill? Certainly, I would have been willing to move the bill. I thought you were asking me if I had seen the amendment. Sorry for the miscommunication there and our head problems. Representative Severson, I had some of the same questions. I centered my points mostly around the word pay a living wage. My concern, Representative Kalin, is I was thinking about the difference in the prevailing wage rate between my district and Representative Saylor's for laborers who could easily be on a school district project here. I'm concerned that this work is going to go to my district and not to Representative Saylor's with the current language. I think, Representative Severson, your concerns mostly center around the words pay a living wage on line 1.26. I'm wondering, Representative Kalin, if we shouldn't, for the time being, consider deleting just those four words as this project moves through the labor committees and such. I actually am concerned. The labor rate is significantly different between our two districts. You may not, Representative Huntley is lucky. He's got a high prevailing labor rate in his community, but Representative Saylor does not. I'm not sure any school districts in your district, Representative Saylor, may meet the criteria here to get any of the work.
Representative Morgan, then we'll hear from you, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an interesting amendment, and this is one of the reasons I think that we ought to focus our efforts on amending this bill in the areas that we and our staff here have expertise on. I don't know if we have staff here who can answer questions about prevailing wage and living wage and what that would mean and what that would do. Those things are not, I think, as I understand it, in the scope of our committee. I personally would prefer that this kind of amendment be dealt with in the Workforce Development Committee, where they have the expertise and the staff with the expertise to answer those kinds of questions. That's just my particular concern, and Madam Chair, maybe you have a response.
I'm going to let the author respond first, and then I'll maybe come in. President Kamen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members in general. I share the commitment to making sure that we have an open process, that it is available to all sectors of the economy, as well, and I think Representative McNamara's point about geographic distribution, we've actually seen that on the Green Jobs Task Force, where folks in southwestern Minnesota, Madam Chair, your home county, from growing up, your native county, I guess, one would say, where they need electricians, and we've had union electricians on the ITV conference, and you know that wage has been the hurdle there. I'd ask that folks oppose the amendment, but with the commitment to continue to work out how do we end up making sure that we do have an open process. And I can tell you that that the trades and labor community has expressed that they can't meet the full need here, even if we were to want to actually target and say you have to absolutely go with union prevailing wage jobs, and notice it doesn't say prevailing wage, I mean, out of a deliberate decision. But we'll continue to work on that. The unions know that they can't meet this need alone, and we need to have an ability to meet that need all across the board. I'll just reiterate, I think that we don't want to be handing out job applications and assistance applications at the same time. That's my prime concern there on the living wage issue.
And Madam Chair, just closing, I understand your concerns. I guess my concern on that one would be, what if the labor unions had come back and said, you know what, yeah, this will fit our need and we'll still have people on the bench? Then are we steering it directly towards the labor unions, or are we really going to open this up for economic development to the people that are sitting on the bench now, who aren't associated with labor unions, who are looking for another job? So I think in terms of this amendment being able to open up the intent of your bill, Representative Kalin, I think this speaks to that, that this is about economic development. This is about an incentive package that everybody in the state has eligible access to. And so I would encourage support for the amendment.
Okay, the amendment is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
No. Motion failed, and amendment did not pass. We have another amendment on the table here, and we have a committee in here shortly, so I'm hoping we can get to this amendment, and if not, we'll have to reconvene.
And Madam Chair, if I might actually I don't mean to cut Representative McNamara off or the chair, but I think it might help to just frame things a little bit, that I think that the spirit of what Representative McNamara will be offering...
Got to move it.
What's that?
Got to move the amendment.
He's got to move the amendment.
Okay.
Let's set him off
his
amendment. Representative McNamara.
I was hoping to do some expedited full forward.
Would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the H.L. 680A1
okay.
amendment.
Representative McNamara moves the amendment that ends in 680A1.
Madam Chair, just real quick, Representative Kalin, there may be some discussion about my inclusion of lines on my amendment line. I'm trying to find it. It's the Education 323. Lines 1-8 and 1-9 of my amendment refer to, I am sorry, the lines, excuse me, it would be the lines that deal with lines, two, yes, I said that right, line 1-8-1-9, Madam Chair, deal with the school district building, but Representative Kalin, if you'll notice on page 3, lines 3.23 and lines 3.24, we have the possibility that we will have school district buildings involved under the administration of the Minnesota Housing and Finance Agency. Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, I'll leave it up to you. If you want me to delete those two lines, just I want to respect you wanting to keep it in the purview of the committee. I think it's possible, and I can get into the gist of it, but if you want to first, I'll leave it up to you.
Which two lines are they on the amendment?
It's the two lines, Madam Chair, that deal with school district buildings, but I think there's a chance, Madam Chair, that we'll have a school district. The amendment is lines 1-8 and 1-9.
Okay. Representative Kalin, do you want to respond both to the amendment and to the office on the...
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, I'll just quickly address lines 1.5 to 1.11 in your amendment, which I believe eliminates the sole sourcing in all three sections, 3, 4, and 5, for fast-track contracting.
Well, and that was my intent, Madam Chair.
Representative McNamara.
And,
Representative Kalin.
And I can make a commitment to Representative McNamara that our intention, after working out with the Department of Administration, they've been working for 6 months on a sole source framework, and we were hopeful that we could figure this out, but I don't think it's workable at this point. And so my plan is when we get to the Energy Committee to drop those provisions. And so I just look to you, Madam Chair. I don't want to bring in issues that are outside. I think Representative Morgan and I share those concerns about staying within the purview of the committee. But Representative McNamara, I will be taking out the sole sourcing.
Well, Madam Chair, let's adopt this. Representative Kalin, I intend to support the amendment, or the bill, I should say. But if your intention is to take it out, let's take it out. I got to be honest, because you said yourself this is 8 to 9 times the current workload. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be making people sign on to contracts that are 2 years ago at different economic times. I think we should adopt the amendment if you're in agreement with me. And because this is a terrific project, it's exactly the kind of stuff. What do we have? 35% unemployed in Local 110 in the Electricians mm-hmm. Union. This is going to do huge stuff. So I think, Representative Kalin, this is under the purview of this committee, this stuff, and it's consistent, I think, if we would adopt this amendment. If you know, okay.
Briefly, Madam Chair, actually, just looking at, I chose the wrong line on the amendment to isolate. Lines 3, 4, and 5 on the amendment relate to the weatherization language in the DE amendment 2.13 to 2.15 that refers to the wanting to deploy quickly by not reinventing the wheel and using the Community Action Partnership, the CAF agencies first. We believe that at some point we may have to look at some innovative ways of delivering these services, but I think that I oppose those portions of the amendment. I do support Representative McNamara's desire to get rid of the sole source reference in sections 3, 4, and 5, so I don't know, I might have to oppose the amendment because I think we need the CAF to make the weatherization work and to get people to work quickly, but with that, I would also pledge to Representative McNamara to work with them to answer any questions he has and also to eliminate the sole source.
Representative McNamara,
do it really quick. Madam Chair, I move to divide the amendment.
McNamara moves to divide the amendment.
Between,
at which line?
Between line 1.5 and 1.6, and I would move lines 1.6 through 1.11 first. I believe, Representative Kalin, that would remove the part that you would like to discuss further.
Madam Chair?
Representative Kalin.
If staff that's available that tracking might be able to just confirm that we are just doing the sole source language there and nothing else. I'm seeing a lot of head nods. So if we're not, then I will go back in and have to restore language, but with a later amendment in the Energy Committee. But
well, I'm going
to. I'm trying to understand.
So I support the amendment.
You support the amendment.
The second half of the amendment.
Removing line 1.6 to line 1.11. Representative McNamara moves the deletion. Removes that amendment.
I'm dividing the amendment, Madam Chair, and I'd like to take the second half up first.
We got that.
Okay.
Okay. Do you want to read back the amendment to make sure everybody understands?
Representative McNamara, you're moving to delete 1.6 to 1.11.
To pass it, actually.
You're moving to pass that section.
Right. I'm going to divide
the. We divided the amendment.
Okay. And move the second half.
And we are now moving the second half. That's right.
Okay.
Okay. Got it. Everybody's got it? Okay. That amendment is before us. And the author agrees. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and that the bill is amended.
Madam Chair, I'm going to go real quick. Representative Kalin, I'm going to drop the first part of the amendment because you've committed to working on it, but we have to be really careful. This says we must fully utilize. Mm-hmm. We don't want to put somebody in a box that has to realize a contract that... Representative Kalin, how do you want to do it? This is under the purview of this committee. Is it going to be dealt with like in the Energy Committee then?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, it's the Office of Energy Security that manages these contracts, these funds, and with the Community Action Partnership. And I have that concern over the word fully as well. So we'll have to talk to the Office of Energy Security and work out to make sure we're not tying our hands too much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to remove the first part of the amendment and withdraw that part.
Representative McNamara withdraws the remainder of the amendment. The bill is now before us as amended. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are numerous other provisions in here I think we need to take a hard, long look at, and it's under this purview of this committee, and if there are not going to be opportunities for this committee to address those again in the future with a revisit, then, Madam Chair, I'd ask that maybe we could lay this over and then pick it up on the next committee hearing.
Well, Representative Kalin, your desire is to move the bill along, I believe, right, because of the... six committee that we need to go through and to be ready when those federal dollars come. So I'm not going to do that, Representative Stevenson, at this point. And I think that right now the bill is on the table and the motion is before us.
Madam Chair, then to that issue, then I would hope that we could vote this bill down, that we could have the opportunity to have those discussions in here. We're talking about fair and transparent processes in which we bring the bills forward, have the full debate, and see all of the issues that deal with this committee as it goes forth, resolve those issues. So, Madam Chair, I would hope that we can vote against this, continue to have this discussion, and put out a product out of this committee that is commensurate with a good government. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, the motion is on the table. Representative Lane's motion to pass House File 680. And refer it as amended to pass and return to finance, from which it will then go to about five other committees. Okay. All those in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way for passage.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, committee members. The meeting is adjourned.